Good afternoon, and welcome to the second panel of today's NATO conference, co-organized by the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, or NUPI, and the New Strategic Centre, and also LSE Ideas. My name is Megan Palmer, and I manage the Central and Southeast Europe programme at LSE Ideas. I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to chair this panel. In this session, we will consider security challenges to the Arctic and the High North. These regions have become areas of increased attention in recent years. Climate change is dramatically altering the Arctic, which is warming faster than anywhere else on Earth. The melting ice is revealing new maritime and resource opportunities, but also security vulnerabilities for Arctic states. And these changes have not gone unnoticed by those further afield. In order to examine these issues in greater detail, I'd like to introduce our three panelists in the order in which they will speak. Colonel Per-Erik Solli recently retired from the Norwegian military, where he served as defense attaché to the Netherlands and held several posts in the Ministry of Defense and all levels in the defense organization. He started his military career as an operational F-16 pilot in the Arctic at the end of the Cold War. In 1999 to 2000, he was a member of the Norwegian Chief of Defence's Strategic Defence Review. He was a senior military advisor at NUPI in 2011 to 2014, and also staff member for the Defence Minister's Expert Commission on Norwegian Security and Defence Policy in 2014 to 2015. Following on from Colonel Solli, Professor Jakob Godzimirski is a research professor at NUPI and has been working on Russian foreign and security policy issues at NUPI for more than 25 years, paying special attention to the role of energy resources in Russian grand strategy. In addition, he has worked on European policy and its impact on developments in Central and Eastern Europe, including relations with Russia. And finally, we will be joined by Dr. Rebecca Pinkus, who is Assistant Professor at the Center for Naval Warfare Studies at the US Naval War College. Her work focuses on the strategic implications of Arctic change and the nexus of environment and security. Prior to the Navy, she worked on Arctic research for the US Coast Guard. So, in this session, I've asked each panelist to speak for up to 15 minutes, and then we will open up the discussion to a conversation between the panel, and also we will incorporate questions from the audience. So, please do share your questions with us using the Q&A function at the bottom of your screens. Please do feel free to add them as the talk goes along rather than waiting for the end. We will ask you to vote for your favorite questions once you feel are most relevant, and we will do our best to address as many as we can in the question and answers section. And so I'd like to hand over to Colonel Solli to take the floor. Colonel Solli.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the introduction, and also thank you for the invitation to speak at this event. I will address security challenges to the Arctic by first elaborating on the High North and the Arctic itself, discuss some of the activities we see, the increasing activity due to the climate change and the retreating ice, and finally discuss militarization in the region. So, starting off with the High North and the Arctic itself, if you take a grand view of the situation, it's over time, and the state of governance and dialogue in the Arctic has been favorable, but the situation has become more difficult now after 2014. So today the picture is more mixed. One important point to think about while discussing the Arctic is that the Arctic is an ocean. In some discussions, people tend to mirror image the Antarctica, the South Pole, to the Arctic, and but this is a landmass where no nation state has sovereignty, and there's an international treaty governing the area. But as the Arctic Ocean is regulated by maritime law, in 2008 we had a very important declaration at Ilulissat in Greenland. The Arctic Five, United States, Canada, Denmark with the Greenland, Norway, and also Russia all agreed that we should apply the same international law in the Arctic Ocean as elsewhere. So, as a function of the maritime law and international maritime law and the UN United Nations Convention on Law of the Seas. There's nation states around the Arctic Ocean with territorial waters, economic exclusive zones, and also international water in the middle, as we see elsewhere in other oceans. The high north in the Arctic is a fairly well-regulated area. If we look at diverging or overlapping claims and so forth, compared to, for instance, the South China Sea. In all the Arctic nations, the coastal nations, they have forwarded their extended continental shelf claims to the UN Commission according to the procedure in UNCLOS. And also bilateral issues are dealt with by neighboring states. Norway and Russia, we signed an agreement agreeing on the delimitation line in Barents Sea in 2010, after 40 years of negotiations. The drilling of oil and gas on land and at sea, and also the fishing activity and so forth, you see, and the resource extraction from the Arctic Ocean mainly occurs in where the nation states have sovereignty in territorial waters, economic zones, but also on land. So there are actually very few resources in the international waters beyond the exclusive economic zones. And there's also that part of the Arctic Ocean where it's deepest, very many thousand meters deep. Back in 2018, there was a 10-year anniversary for the initial declaration. The same Arctic Five with other Arctic nations and also some other international partners agreed on a temporary fishing ban in the mid-Arctic part of the international waters. But also importantly, there's a lot of bilateral cooperation. For instance, Russia and Norway, we have a joint fishery commission formed in the 1970s, the coldest part of the Cold War, where we annually agree on the fishing quotas in the Barents Sea based on research into the stock and the situation of the cod stock in the region and other types of fish. And also in conjunction with that, we also have a bilateral Coast Guard cooperation with the Russians. So we side by side annually enforce the quotas we set together. There's also other examples of the Coast Guard cooperation in the Arctic. You have the North Atlantic Coast Guard Forum and also the Arctic Coast Guard Forum that was formed just recently. And they also include Russia, by the way. There are several forums for dialogue and cooperation between nation states in the Arctic. The Arctic Council is one example, but also the Barents Europe Atlantic Council. However, they cannot be mirror image or compared to institutions like the NATO and the EU because they don't have any permanent staff, there's no delegations, and it's basically rotational chairmanship. One thing is important to note that important declarations like the ILOSAT Declaration of 2008 stating that international maritime law applies to the area was done outside the Arctic Council. So I see in some of the international debate, they tend to exaggerate, the importance and role of the Arctic Council as far as sovereignty in the region. But however, it's important forums for dialogue and research and also for find areas of collaboration in peacetime. Regarding human activity in the Arctic, of course, that has changed recently. But the change is very slow and it's very gradual. The maritime activity has increased. The most talked about topic is the transpolar traffic between the Pacific Ocean and the North Atlantic Ocean. But this traffic, the volume is still below 100 per year. Most of the traffic inside the Arctic is local. It's between to the Arctic and also inside the Arctic itself. Especially the activity in the Yamal area, the peninsula, where they have a huge increase now of production of gas and oil, and where the export has increased significantly from that area, and the transport, and both the European and continent, United States, but also to Asia from that part. The on-land and offshore drilling for petroleum has slowly increased in the area, but still not as much as predicted, for instance, 10 years ago, because it's very expensive to do that in this part of the world, which still has a very harsh environment still, if the temperature is increasing in the region. The fishing has increased somewhat, but also due to the retracting ice, the fishing activity has gone further north and straining the capabilities and the challenges for the governments, for instance, responsible for search and rescue. The ultimate nightmare is due to the increased tourism and also the cruise boat activities in the Arctic. And for instance, an incident with thousands of a cruise boat with thousands of passengers on board, for instance, north of Svalbard, would definitely be a huge challenge for the capabilities we have at hand. All this human activity that increases slowly but gradually in the Arctic and also moves further north requires more safety regimes in place. And I mean, the cargo vessels then need support by icebreakers, not naval vessels, because there's not a military threat per se intervening with their activities. They need towing vessels if they have an engine failure. They need search and rescue capabilities if they are having any incidents. And also, if you have any pollution, we need oil spill recovery capabilities in the region. However, a very odd development is now that the Russians are now shortly introducing new icebreakers with missile capabilities. But regarding militarization of the Arctic, I don't like that word very much, because if you look back in history, the Arctic has been militarized almost continuously now since World War II. It was a huge, the Barents Sea and also the Scandinavian northwestern part of Russia was a huge battleground in World War II. And also in the Cold War, there were a vast number of military forces present in the area, both land-based and sea-based. However, after Cold War, there was still a military footprint there, both in Alaska, Canada, Norway, and Russia. But it seems to be forgotten. So now, after the 2014 sanctions, when the focus is as increased on the military situation with Russia, but also the military forces they have up in the northwestern part of the Kola Peninsula, they have been there most of the time, and there's an increase from not from zero, but from the forces that were there in the 90s and also in the 2000s. But however, the chance of military conflict erupting in the Arctic itself is still low, because there's very little to fight for. Most of the resources are in control of the nation states, both at land but also at sea. Maritime disputes and disagreements have so far been solved through the international law mechanisms and also through diplomatic negotiations. However, the security in the region is very vulnerable for spillover effects if the Russian-Western relations are becoming more tense due to situations arising elsewhere. What we've seen in the Arctic is that after 2008, when Russia decided to play a different role internationally than it had done after the Cold War in the first couple of decades, they increased their activity, but also started a military modernization program that also had an impact, because we saw more naval vessels sailing outside Norway and also in the Barents Sea, all the way down to the North Sea. A lot of more long-range aviation flying in the same area. But the major event was in 2014, when the Ukraine invaded by the Russians, and there was an extension of the Crimea, the illegal activity there, and also the sanctions that came about. And that had impact, because all the arrangements we had in place regarding military cooperation were halted, and the Chief of Defense meeting, the Arctic Security Forces Roundtable, all the staff talks, and also the common exercises we had with them. However, everything regarding Coast Guard and other safety related issues are still in place and operational. But also a lot of the mechanisms to have a dialogue between nation states like the Arctic Council is also operational in the region. But after the U.S. National Security Strategy of 2017 was published, and the U.S. now re-emphasized the great power competition, that has led to a new pattern of military activity in the Arctic, but also in the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea, and also around in the Western Pacific area. So this the U.S. dynamic force employment that includes both naval vessels, but also bomber aircraft flying sometimes alone, other times together with allies in the close proximity of both Russia, but also China, has also impacted the Arctic. So so this year in the Barents Sea, we have seen a degree of presence of U.S. naval and U.S. Air Force activity that we'd never seen before. The U.S. Navy, they call it these type of operations in the Arctic and Barents Sea for free navigation operations, as they traditionally only are done in the Western Pacific area. But they seem to make a point that they, not only in the Barents Sea, but also in the Baltics and the Black Sea, that they all area outside the territorial water, the 12 nautical miles, is international waters, and the Russia and also China in the Pacific does not have any special rights in those areas. But the bottom line in the Arctic is that the Russians have a formidable military force in the Kola Peninsula area, and that will have a major impact on Northern Europe and also the North Atlantic if there's an armed conflict between the Russia and the Western state. If you look at the order of battle, they have about 60% of their nuclear missiles based on submarines in the region, about 400 according to open sources. They have eight strategic submarines, 22 other types of submarines, or 40 naval vessels, more than 100 military aircraft, and they can also be easily and reinforced from other parts of Russia. And they will not deploy into the Arctic. They will most likely deploy further south, in all the way down to, at least on the maritime side, they will deploy all the way down to the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap. But for Norway, we try to deal with this situation being close to this huge military complex of both having in place mechanisms for deterrence, but also reinsurance. We don't want to step on them in their near proximity where they do the normal exercise and employment. However, but we have to be quite firm and also together with the allies react on the provocations and also unnecessary activity from their side. We have some safety mechanisms for the security side. One is the Incidents at Sea Agreement still applies for both, and we have a regular meeting with the Russians on that, and the same applies with the United States and United Kingdom. And also between Norway and Russia, between our national joint headquarters and their Northern Fleet Command, we have a hotline so the military commanders can talk together if something special arises and we need to have a clarification with them. NATO does not have a role in the high north in Arctic in peacetime. And the only exception is the air policing from Norway and occasionally three times a year from Iceland. However, and NATO, they do have a contingency plan to deal with worst case scenarios in crisis and war that not only affect the Arctic in high north, but of course the Northern Europe itself and the North Atlantic. And it's very welcome that the NATO has set up the Joint Force Command Norfolk to address a lot of the maritime challenges we will have in worst case scenarios. One phenomenon that's very predominant is that in addition to NATO, we have a lot of regional security bodies that have arisen lately. And they're complementary to NATO. The first one is the UK Initiative Northern Group, and that encompasses all the Nordic and Baltic states, plus Poland, Germany, Netherlands, and UK, of course. And also the Nordefco, the Nordic cooperation that initially in the first couple of years was rather limited. But after 2014, the the type of cooperation we have between Nordic states on the defense sector and security policy field has increased substantially, and there have been major changes the last couple of years in that arrangement. Also, then another British initiative has been the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is slowly but gradually increasing in importance. And we also see a far larger interest from the US side and UK side and other nations regarding the maritime challenges we will have in crisis and war in the North Atlantic and the High North. But Russia is a moving target. The modernization they initiated back in 2007-2008 is still ongoing. And all of their disruptive technology, their modernization has to be carefully monitored, and we have to also adjust our defense plans accordingly. However, the one of the most serious security problems we have right now is not with with Russia in a potential war. It's actually hybrid threats are a key challenge in peacetime for us. We experience GPS jamming from the just across the border from Russia, interrupting with civilian aviation and a lot of other civilian activities in the border area. We have cyber attacks. We just recently had a cyber attack against our parliament, but also others are affected in every year, every month through various activities. And we also see influence and manipulation operations ongoing, as also has been alluded by the chief of defense of the of Romania in his presentation. But same experience up north with the Russians. So in conclusion, the climate change and less ice has resulted in more human activity and further north in the Arctic. That first and foremost requires more safety-related regimes for to deal with oil spill search and rescue, etc. However, the situation in regarding security in High North can worsen due to spillover effect if the relationship between the Russia and the West becomes even more difficult than it is today, then of course the security situation in the High North and the Arctic will be even more challenging than it is today. And like I said, my final point is that the hybrid threat is not a theory or a potential problem. It is a challenge in peacetime for us. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Colonel Solly. I'd like to hand the floor immediately to Professor Gosumiski. Over to you, Professor.
Thank you very much for being invited to take part in this very interesting session. Contrary to my predecessors, I decided to use some other means of communication to convey the message. So I will use a small PowerPoint presentation to illustrate how to understand those issues that we have been talking about the whole day, and we are going to continue talking about in the coming minutes. I will, as I promised, focus on the Norwegian perspective on the situation in the High North, looking at various aspects of first and foremost the traditional military security, but also at some other issues that somehow influence the relationship in the High North. My presentation is going to focus on two aspects. In the first part, I will look at how is the situation perceived from the Norwegian perspective, and in the second part, I will look at Russia's objectives and interests in the Arctic. Let us start with four maps that will somehow make the situation clearer, because when talking about the Arctic, we quite often use different geographical denominations. It's important to have in mind that Arctic can mean many things to different groups of people. Arctic can be viewed as a purely geographical question, as illustrated in the left top map, and then we have also a tendency to mix the Arctic with what is happening in the Russian part of the Arctic. From the Norwegian perspective, the concept of High North is much more limited in geographical terms than the Arctic. And then we have also those strategic considerations as illustrated by this map showing the main strategic lines of potential conflict in the Arctic. Broadly understood, that is also including the issue of the North Atlantic. We are very happy because only a few weeks ago, the Norwegian government published a new paper, white paper on Norwegian policy in the Arctic, in the High North. And in this document, the situation was described as something that is of interest to both national and international community. And in this document, we have also a number of interests Norwegian authorities have expressed they have in the Arctic. It's about peace, stability, and predictability. It's about international cooperation and the rule of law. It's about comprehensive and ecosystem-based management of resources. It's about increased job and value creation, closer cooperation between business and knowledge institutions, and attractive living and welfare conditions. In my presentation, I will focus on the two first aspects of this cooperation, on the issues of security and international cooperation. The document can also be used in order to somehow map the hierarchy of Norwegian interests in the Arctic. This could be done in two ways. On the one hand, we can look at how those issues are addressed in this document. This is this text version. And on the other hand, we can also look at how many times each of the actors operating in the Arctic is mentioned in this document. And this is this kind of graphic presentation. And we see that there is a lot of focus on Russia as an actor in the Arctic, also from the purely national Norwegian perspective. We also see that there is a huge interest in NATO, in the US presence in the Arctic. EU is also mentioned quite often, 75 times in this newest document. And China is also paid some attention. So we see a kind of map of actors who, from the Norwegian perspective, play an important role in this Arctic backlash high north context. What is maybe the main issue when discussing purely security and military related questions in the Arctic is this question of strategic asymmetry between Norway and Russia. This is something that has been informing Norwegian security and foreign policy for last decades. The fact that Norway decided to join NATO in 1949 was also an expression of this fear of the impact this strategic asymmetry can have. We see that Russia is 50 times bigger than Norway in purely geographical terms, 30 times bigger in demographic terms. When we look at the military aspects of this interaction, then Russia is even more of a challenge from the purely Norwegian and security perspective. This has also somehow been a very important element in Norwegian thinking about security. We quite often refer to something that is called the strategic triangle, the triangle that somehow shows the Norwegian space for strategic maneuver, which is to a very large extent shaped by Norway's relations with three regional and global centers of power. It's about the relationship with the United States. It's about economic cooperation with the European Union, that is the most important economic partner. And it's also to a very large extent about shaping relationship with Russia, that is perceived as the main kind of factor that has to be taken into account when thinking in about the security of the country. The map at the bottom shows the kind of changing perception of the Russian threat in the longer historical perspective. During the Cold War, there was this fear of the Soviet Union invading Norway for purely strategic reasons to take control of the Norwegian coastline. Then during the post-Soviet period, this fear of the Soviet backlash, Russian invasion somehow disappeared. After 2014, there has been a kind of reconsideration of the Norwegian approach to Russia, as exemplified by those two quotes reports from the National Intelligence Service threat assessment published in 2015, but still, even after Russia's use of military power against Ukraine in 2014, the idea was that there is no threat to the territory of Norway coming from Russia in the form of invasion. Relationship to Russia has also been a very important input in Norwegian foreign and security policy, and there have been three main ideas that somehow guided the Norwegian policy towards Russia, and to a very large extent also Norwegian relationship with other actors. I have already mentioned that Norway decided to join NATO in 1949 in order to increase its ability to deter a potential aggression from the Soviet Union and from other actors. So this issue of deterrence has been a very important element in the Norwegian policy. Then and this was somehow a response to this strategic asymmetry that I mentioned. On top of that came also the question of reassurance, having in mind that we had to do with an actor that was located very close in purely geographical terms. It was also important to conduct a policy that would not be provocative, and this resulted in Norway self-imposing some restrictions on its membership in NATO. And then after the collapse of the Soviet system, the third element was added to this that informed Norwegian policy during the Cold War. This was the issue of engagement. A new kind of strategic framework was put in place, and there was a huge hope that Russia could develop into a full-fledged democracy. So it was important to somehow support this Russian transition also at the local level. When we talk about Norwegian policy towards Russia, it's also important to have in mind that what Norway does and thinks about Russia as an actor is also to a very large extent influenced by what Russia does in the region and what are Russia's objectives. This is a kind of very synthetic presentation of the evolution of the Russian strategic thinking from the time of Peter the Great to the post-Soviet period, based on various examinations as presented in several books published by Russian-American scholar Andrei Tsigankov. And his idea was that in the post-Soviet period, Russian policy towards its strategic surroundings were informed by a kind of a conflict between the three ideas. There were those in Russia who meant that Russia should join the West because this was the best way to help Russia address grave problems that the country was facing. Then there were also those who meant that Russia, being a big country, needs a policy that will somehow counterbalance the Western influence in the world. And this was this idea of multipolarity launched by Evgeny Primakov in 1996 when he became Russia's Minister of Foreign Affairs and then Prime Minister. And then with the coming of power to power of Vladimir Putin, Tsigankov meant that Putin has embarked on a kind of very pragmatic policy of seeking cooperation with the West where it was beneficial for Russia, and counterbalancing the West when Russia needed to counterbalance the West. In 2015, Margot Light, leading British expert on Russia, published a very interesting text on Russian foreign policy themes in official documents and speeches. This could be used somehow to reconstruct the main ideas informing Russian policy towards the outside world. And she meant that in this context, we need to understand that Russia was seeking to regain the status of a great power. That was an important element in Russian policy, that Russia perceived NATO as a challenge, at some stages even as a threat, that Russia was not very happy with NATO's eastward expansion because this would mean NATO coming closer to Russia's borders. And then Russia was also very much against the deployment of ballistic missile defense close to Russia's borders. There were also some other aspects of this policy that I'm not going to dwell upon because they have not that much to do with the situation in the Arctic. if we want to understand Russia's approach to the Arctic, we need to place this geographical area in the broader context of the set of Russian ideas that has have informed Russian foreign policy in the longer historical perspective. In 1962, Cyril Black published a very interesting piece of examination of the historical Russian foreign policy, also including the early stage of the Soviet period. And he identified four leitmotifs in Russian foreign and security policy. There's four leitmotifs were stabilization of frontiers. It was about assurance of favorable conditions for economic growth. It was about unification of Russian territories. And Russia was also seemingly very interested in participation in alliance systems and international institutions. When we look at the current examination of Russian foreign and security policy, we find some of those elements still very much present. In 2017, Rand published a very interesting study on Russia's place in the international system as viewed from Moscow, and they identified several of those aspects. It was about defense of the country and the regime. It was about seeking influence in the near abroad. It was about preventing interference in domestic affairs, but it was also, Russia was also interested in political and economic cooperation as a partner equal to other great powers, and Russia was also very much interested in regaining this position in the global system as a great power. In 2014, Dmitry Trenin, one of the leading Russian experts on international affairs, published a small piece on what was to shape the relations in the Arctic in the coming years and even decades. And he identified five issues that were to shape the relations in the Arctic. It was about solving those territorial claims. Per Erik was talking about a little bit and underlined the fact that all Arctic powers have went the legal way to address this issue. It was also about development of various natural resources, first and foremost energy resources that are located in the Arctic. Per Erik also mentioned this. For instance, in 2007 and 2000, between 2007 and 2012, there was a lot of focus on the development of the Shtokman gas field, where Russia sought closer cooperation with Western partners. So it was also about developing new sea lanes in the region. The northern northern sea route is the most important of the projects. And then there was also this idea that the territory in the Arctic will also have a certain strategic military importance, and that the question of what kind of rules, what kind of international regime we will see in the Arctic was also to be addressed in this coming decades. When looking at Russia's ideas, we see this kind of recurring themes. In last month, Sergei Guriev, who is one of the leading Russian economists, but also experts on various other aspects of Russian policy, has conducted two interviews with two leading Russian experts on foreign policy, Alexander Gabuyev, who is affiliated with the Carnegie Moscow office, and Fyodor Lukyanov, who is the head of the leading Russian official think tank working on international affairs. And in those two interviews, although they have approached the issue of foreign policy from different angles, Gabuyev could be understood more as a kind of Russian globalizer, as a Russian institutional liberalist who seeks a kind of closer cooperation with other actors, who means that the main goal of the state is to provide better living conditions for its population, while Lukyanov is could be labeled as Russian realist. But they both underlined the importance of security in the Russian thinking about Russia's place in the world. So this issue of security is something that informs Russian thinking about Russia's place in the world to a very large extent. And we can illustrate the situation by presenting those three maps. One that shows kind of non-politicized world on the left side, the other one showing different understandings of security, the issue of kind of mutual deterrence as something that is shaping situation in along the NATO's eastern flank. And then we also see the kind of Russian perspective on the situation, both in Europe, but also in the broader context, this issue of Russia feeling Russia trying to contain the Western pressure against the country. When we think about this bilateral relationship between Russia and Norway, it's also important to look at what is the perception of Norway as viewed from a Moscow perspective. It's about a small neighbor, it's about this disparity of various types of potentials. It's about Norway being a kind of a small, relatively vulnerable country. But on the other hand, Norway is quite often referred in the Russian official parlance as NATO in the North, as a staunch US ally, as a possible source of threat to Russia's strategic assets in the Northern Bastion, as an active actor in the high north with some common and with some contradicting Arctic interests. Norway is also viewed as an important energy actor, both in the regional context, but also in the broader European context. And last but not least, there is also a small community of people with kind of background from Russia who can also be viewed as a sort of asset from the Russian perspective. I have already mentioned what makes the Arctic important in this bilateral Norwegian-Russian context, and this is a kind of repetition of the ideas that I have already presented on how is the perception of the importance of the Arctic scene from the expert perspective in Moscow. It's again about solving the issue of territorial claims, about energy riches, about sea lanes, about international regime, and about strategic military importance.
May I just intervene here? I apologize, but we're running low on time.
Okay, I will end with this map. This map shows the kind of strategic dimension of Russian thinking about high north in kind of more narrow sense. We know that during the Cold War, this idea of the northern bastion was developed in Russia, and this is still very much something that informs Russian thinking about strategic aspects of the high north. Russia has the key military bases located on 100 kilometers from the Norwegian border. This border is also a border where Russia meets NATO, and this shapes also to a very large extent Russian thinking about security, because as Per Erik mentioned, there is no single reason for Russia going to war against Norway, but there is also this thinking about possible so-called horizontal spillover effects, that if in case Russia has a strategic problem or is in a kind of conflict with NATO in other places in Europe, this could also have a kind of spillover effect on the situation in the high north. And this is something that shapes both the Russian and the Norwegian thinking about this border. The border is not very long, 196 kilometers, but it's a border that is exceptional from a purely strategic point of view. As Per Erik mentioned, Russia has two-thirds of its second strike capability located on the 100 kilometers from these borders, and Russia needs also access to sea areas along the Norwegian coast in order to be able to project its military power to an area that is important from the Russian strategic point of view in case of a possible conflict, because it's not only about projecting power to Norway, it's also about preventing closer strategic cooperation in the case of a conflict between the United States States and Canada, the North American NATO partners and NATO partners in Europe. So this is somehow what explains this kind of situation in the strategic terms seen from both the Norwegian and from the Russian perspective. Thank you for your attention, and I will be glad to address a number of questions that should eventually come towards the end of this presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Godzminski. We just ran a little over, so I'd like to immediately hand over to Dr. Pincus.
Thank you very much. I also have just a few slides that I will share. Let me begin full screen. So at the outset, I just need to note that while I work at the US Naval War College, I am sharing my personal opinions today, and I am in no way speaking for the United States Navy. I just need to make that clear at the outset. And the first point that, so I'm gonna zoom out a little bit, and I really appreciate the first two speakers for drilling into some of the details about Russian military thinking and the situation with Norway and Denmark. But what I wanna do is sort of zoom out a little bit and talk about sort of what's the broader picture in the Arctic region. And the first point that I really wanna make is that there is transformative change going on in the Arctic across multiple domains. So you're all aware of the enormous environmental changes taking place as the Arctic region warms faster, four times faster than any other part of the globe. Arctic sea ice, which is sort of the organizing characteristic of the Arctic region, is shrinking very rapidly, as this graph illustrates. It's in unmistakable steep declines, and we will expect an ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime, probably sometime in the 2030s or maybe 2040. It's happening very fast, and a key thing to remember or to bear in mind is that sea ice melt and warming in the Arctic is happening faster than our models had predicted. So it's moving really, really fast, and it's having a whole suite of environmental changes. It's not just sea ice, but it's also melting permafrost, which makes engineering very problematic on land. We're seeing permafrost collapse, creating a number of crises related to infrastructure. The tsunami in Greenland a couple of years ago was linked to permafrost thaw driving coastal collapse that actually triggered the tsunami. So there's an enormous number of environmental crises going on. Also, fish stocks are moving in response to warming. We're seeing new invasive species enter the area. As Per Erik noted, we're seeing an enormous jump in tourism, as tourists want to come see the Arctic before it melts away. And so there's sort of this massive amount of environmental change across the whole system that creates a lot of uncertainty. There's also a tremendous amount of political change going on. And part of that is the return of great power competition at sort of a high level, but also at lower levels, regional governments are increasingly empowered to make decisions, particularly about natural resource use. So in the last several years, we've seen national governments increasingly devolve authority to smaller sub-national government units. And a really good example of that is Greenland, right? So the 2009 Self-Rule Act handed over a great deal of autonomy to the Greenlandic government. And the Greenlandic government is now much more empowered in relative balance to Copenhagen than it was before. And that's not confined to Greenland. Similar patterns have been going on in Canada, and also in across sort of broader Scandinavia. The Sami communities have also taken a stronger role in decision-making. So there's political changes going on at sort of high level and lower level that also creates some level of uncertainty. There's an amount of technological change taking place. Obviously, we're seeing an enormous amount of disruptive new technologies, particularly unmanned and autonomous technology, as well as new communications technologies penetrating into the Arctic region and changing how business is conducted and how communities make decisions. And there's an economic change taking place. And so the key piece here is that there is so much change going on that there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of really multi-part challenges that we're confronting. And there's a lot of instability in the system right now. And that is layered on top of this sort of growing security tension. One thing that's interesting about the Arctic region is there is no regional hegemon. While the US is sort of the global great power in the system, when you look at the Arctic basin in particular, Russia is by far the dominant geographic power. Russian coastline is about half of Arctic coastline. It has the most population and the most military sort of depth across the Arctic basin. And so that's a really interesting situation. And we're seeing, as the two speakers ahead of me have already mentioned, that both the United States and Russia are modernizing long-lasting defenses in the region. I really appreciate Per-Erik noting that militarization of the Arctic is not a new phenomenon, but we're seeing a modernizing of the military buildup there. And we're seeing a lot of interest in particular on the Russian side because they have these core national interests. So the Northern Sea Route and also the natural resources in the Arctic are really crucial to Russia's future. And we're seeing a growing amount of military activity, patrols, exercises, deployments. On the Russian side, these take a very troubling form. So snap exercises or levels of bomber patrols or submarine activity that we haven't seen in decades. And this creates a lot of instability and the possibility of a security dilemma where each side, Russia and NATO, sees the other side taking actions that make it feel threatened and feel the need to respond to reassure themselves in a way that the other side then feels threatening. And so there's this sort of classic security dilemma emerging in the Arctic region. And so on top of all of this, we have questions about the proper role of NATO. And there is an ongoing debate right now about what NATO's role in the region should be. There are calls for NATO to take on a stronger role, and that could be through things like threat assessments, increased operations, surveillance activities, or other sorts of engagement. A lot of these debates circle around the fact that there is no security-focused forum in the Arctic region right now that includes Russia. So Jakob mentioned the Arctic Council, which is sort of the primary governance forum, but it does not address hard security topics. It's explicitly banned from doing so. The Arctic Security Forces Roundtable, which was a meeting of high-level Arctic military representatives, has not included Russia following the Crimea incident in 2014, and neither has the Arctic Chiefs of Defense meeting. And so those forums have barred Russia for the last 6 years. And there are some people who call for Russia to be readmitted to the Arctic Security Forces Roundtable, for example, but it's hard to see on what ground, it's hard to see that as anything but a concession, I would say. And so there are voices saying it's appropriate for NATO to step into this void. I'm just going to give you a couple thoughts. I'll move through these slides quickly so we can get through to the discussion. But I think it's worth thinking about the two hats that NATO wears. NATO is an operational military alliance. It conducts operations and it builds plans to exercise capabilities as a military alliance. But it's also an organizational structure that formalizes dialogue, not only among NATO allies, but also with partners and also with Russia. And NATO explicitly right now is pursuing this dual track approach towards Russia, comprised of meaningful dialogue and a very strong and growing defense posture. And so I think it's useful thinking about how the Arctic would fit into that dual track approach. I would argue that increasing operations, particularly sort of explicitly contingency focused exercises, will contribute to this escalating security dilemma. And we're seeing a bit of that where following Trident Juncture exercise and the big NATO exercise, we saw some Russian snap exercises, and we're seeing a lot of activity up in the Barents this year. And in response, we typically see Russian forces coming out. And so there is this sort of in the US, we use the term tit for tat, right, where there's sort of this call and response dynamic going on. And it raises the question of how you demonstrate the strength of an alliance without conducting shows of strength that your target is going to find threatening. When we think about the organizational attributes of NATO. One argument that I've made and been attacked for, but I think it's worth raising, is the question of the NATO-Russia Council. And it is this mechanism for consultation, and it could establish an ad hoc working group on the Arctic, and that would be, I think, something worth considering in the current climate. I've been told that the NATO-Russia Council is ineffective and that everything associated with NATO is alarming to Russia, and I acknowledge both of those criticisms. I would argue that a security forum is largely focused on reassurance rather than sort of substantive accomplishments. Most of the major security issues in the Arctic, like submarine activity, are not really going to be addressed substantively, but a security forum would create some dialogue and trust building or confidence building mechanisms. And I think that that sort of targets that question about ineffectiveness. The other few thoughts that I'm going to leave you with is that others have called for a new security forum in the Arctic. That would be extremely challenging. There's important questions about who should be involved, who shouldn't be involved, particularly with growing interest in the Arctic from China. Any sort of security forum that involved non-Arctic states outside of the parameters of NATO, I think we would see sort of global interest in that forum, and that would be really challenging, I think. I've already mentioned revising the Arctic Council would really decrease stability in the region. The OSCE might be a useful mechanism. We can have a debate. This is a NATO-focused conference, so I'll leave it for the discussion for thoughts about that. But I think those are a couple of ideas I'd like to offer you all to think about. And in conclusion, I'm just going to provide a quote here from Russia's Arctic ambassador. And he specifically calls out the growing activity of non-Arctic NATO members in the Arctic region. And so I think that leads me to think about the Russian NATO Council and NATO itself as a mechanism that may contribute to increasing stability in the region, supporting this dual track approach, and getting sort of the right sized security forum so that we can have a dialogue that reduces tensions, walks us away from the security dilemma, but fits with NATO's approach of both engaging while demonstrating the resolve and cohesion of the alliance. I think I'll probably stop there because I know we're running a little bit low on time, and I think I've already burned through about 12 minutes. I'm looking forward to your questions in the debate, and this is something that I have been working on and had a number of conversations with other folks, and I think it's a really fascinating topic, and the Arctic is such a unique place right now because it is an area where there is this tremendous amount of change cascading across domains, and we really need sources of stability and continuity. And NATO's 70-year history of being a very familiar institution, warts and all, I think makes it an important actor in the Arctic region as it goes through this period of change. I'm going to stop there and look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pincus. And I will forego any sort of summary of what's been said so far, just so that we can have as much discussion as possible. So we've had a number of questions, also a few that are legacy questions from the first panel that should be addressed in this this panel. But before we get into, I'd just like to pick up on the subject of governance, which you have each in different ways raised. There's a position which says that interstate rivalry is unlikely to arise in the Arctic for reasons that are internal to the region, and that if there are security issues in the Arctic, there's spillover to the other Arctic states. And so as a result, there won't be an escalation of rivalry and tensions. I wondered how you would each respond to that. Perhaps I'll go first to Colonel Solly.
Sorry, I just had to unmute my microphone. It's a good question. So far, both in the Cold War, but also in recent times, the governance of the Arctic between the Arctic states themselves and also type of mechanism that has evolved, you know, from the 1970s and onwards today, seem to be quite robust, and the principles of maritime law seem to be very strong, also after 2014. And a lot of the mechanisms for dialogue between nation states on non-military matters are also in place now after 2014. There's very hard to find any reason why any non-military issues would actually affect the situation in the Arctic itself. So far, so good. Like I said, the region is very, very vulnerable to spillover effects from tensions arising elsewhere.
Thank you. And Professor Godzimirski, do you have a similar position, or do you feel somewhat differently?
I think that we have seen a lot of hope that the Arctic was to be somehow shielded from the tensions elsewhere, but we have also seen, unfortunately, some tensions rising. We had, in fact, at NUPI a project between 2016 and 2019 that was to look into those questions. And as a result of this project, we published also several studies. A colleague of ours, Julia Wilhelmsen, has published two very interesting pieces of examination of the Russian and the Norwegian political discourse on each other. She discovered that although the hope to start with was that the Arctic would be shielded from those tensions, that there is a growing level of increasing level of tension in the relations, at least in the way each one speaks about each other. So this is something that has not been successful. But on the other hand, we see also that those ideas that have been informing Norwegian policy towards Russia and the Soviet Union are still there. There is a lot of focus on deterrence, but also very much on reassurance. The level of direct engagement in Russia has gone down in the aftermath of 2014 because there are some developments in Russia that make this cooperation engagement even more difficult. For instance, the introduction of the law on foreigners and foreigners' actions in Russia has cut under many of the cooperation projects. The hope is still that at some moment we will see the end of this tension, but it's much easier to provide a diagnosis, much more difficult to find the medicine to this.
Well, perhaps in the sense that's adding weight to Dr. Pinkus's case for having a new security forum. Dr. Pinkus, what's your thoughts on this question?
I would agree with both Peric and Jakob that there are no immediate drivers of conflict in the Arctic right now. Territorial claims are largely resolved, and honestly, the two boundary claims that are unresolved are currently between the US and Canada and Canada and Denmark, and those are very sort of friendly boundary disputes. There is an ongoing dispute about extension of the extended continental shelf in the central Arctic, as Per-Eric noted, but that is unlikely, virtually impossible that would ever drive conflict anytime in the next decade or two, because those claims are far offshore, under deep water, and there's no immediate prospect of them being economically viable. However, I do worry about spillover from tensions outside of the region. Also, the growing tempo of military exercises creates the possibility of friction or mishap, and in the absence of communication, that could easily spiral. And so most of the people that I speak to worry about some type of unintentional accident creating a crisis situation. I appreciate Per-Eric flagging the cruise ship accident scenario. You know, some sort of humanitarian disaster could potentially also get very complicated depending on where it occurred and sort of what countries were involved. But I think at this point, the likelihood is some sort of accident creating a real crisis.
If I may add a word here.
Please.
I think that it's important to have in mind that NATO adopting this policy of dual track approach to Russia, based on the one hand on deterrence and on the other hand of on dialogue, maybe we should consider adding a third element, communication, because dialogue is not only about communication, it's also about seeking joint solutions to problems and so on and so on, while communication is important to avoid, namely, what Rebecca mentioned, mishaps, misunderstandings, miscalculations. And in that sense, there are still some lines of communication open that may help avoid those most dangerous situations. There is a direct communication line between the Norwegian military headquarters in the north and the northern fleet headquarters. So there is still sort of precautions that can be taken in order to avoid those misperceptions.
Thank you. I'd like to turn to some audience questions now, as I'm aware we only have 10 minutes left on the schedule. So we had a number of them. One has come in from the first panel. I believe that the person who asked the question is still with us. The question was from Viorel Manole, who is the executive director of Patromil, which is the Romanian National Defence Industry Association. Viorel asks, please, could you comment on the future need for military vessels required when the North Sea / ocean will be open to navigation? And is the industry prepared for building those? I don't know who would like to take on the naval construction question.
I could try a very short answer. The all military, but also all civilian, all vessels, you know, they need to be specially designed for Arctic regions. Even if the ice retreats, you still have a lot of drifting ice and so forth, and difficult conditions. And so the International Maritime Organization, they just recently published the Polar Code, you know, regulating what type of safety measures and extra construction measures that have been placed for vessels operating up there. So it's even if due to global warming, the ice melts and retracts, it's still very difficult there to operate. And they need, even if it's civilian military, you still need specialized vessels.
Thank you. I'm going to move on now. We've had several questions on the subject of climate change. I'm going to pick up on a question from Hugh Dowson, and I hope that this will answer the other audience members' questions also. He asked, can the panel comment on climate change and its implications for NATO? Perhaps Dr. Pincus might like to take this.
I would be happy to. Climate change is obviously just an enormous sort of umbrella of effects, right? And so we're seeing a tremendous amount of warming in the Arctic region. The Arctic is warming about four times faster than the rest of the globe. I'm sure you've all seen the headlines in the last few years about forest fires burning across Siberia and melting permafrost, and you know, everyone knows what's going on, right? And that's, as I alluded to earlier, it's causing a number of cascading changes that pose challenges for NATO. Although you know, it's sort of, NATO isn't the only one who's challenged right now. We think about permafrost thaw. We think about invasive species. We think about changing storm patterns. There's a lot more storms occurring in the Arctic, and we're seeing changing climatic problems like freezing fog, icing, you know, some more navigational problems, the drifting ice that Per-Erik noted. So there's a number of maritime challenges. The ocean profile is changing. So salinity and sea surface temperature and mixing are also changing as well, which is going to have some carry-on changes, movement of fish species. And so there's just sort of a number of challenges. There's a higher likelihood of natural disaster, and we can imagine that NATO might be involved in some sort of large-scale disaster. Infrastructure, built infrastructure, is threatened by permafrost thaw. Countries that have to pay for adaptation may have challenging budget pressures associated with NATO contributions. You know, different kinds of platforms may be needed. And then there's the sort of resource extraction question. So it's a great question. It's really complicated. There's a lot of different environmental changes going on. I think it's worth kind of parsing out how directly they are connected to the NATO mission. So I always come back to that.
Thank you. And I'd just like to stay with NATO. There are two questions that I'm going to bunch together, and this is open to all the panel. The first is from Lou Coatney, who asks about the Nordic balance, which was an understanding that there would not be any foreign troops based in Norway permanently. And he asks, has that concept now been superseded? I'd like to bundle that together with a question more explicitly about NATO, which is, this came in from Ian Livermore, and it's directed to you, Dr. Pinkus, but I'm sure everyone will have an opinion on this. The question is, how can NATO in any way be part of serious Arctic security discussions with Russia when the Kremlin has adamantly stated that Arctic security is for the Arctic states alone? So considering those two questions about permanent foreign troop bases in Norway and also about the acknowledgement of NATO being involved by Russia, who would like to step in first and address
maybe
that?
Maybe I can start with this issue of permanent deployment of foreign troops on the Norwegian territory. This has been a topic that was relatively high on the bilateral agenda over the past 5 years in Norway discussion with Russia. There have been a lot of disinformation about this issue because the deployment of the rotational deployment of US Marines in Norway was presented as a kind of idea of establishing a permanent military base. Then the location of this base was also misrepresented in the Russian media. It was said that it was very close to the Russian border, while it was 1,500 kilometers from the Russian-Norwegian border. So this is something that has been played heavily by Russian disinformation machinery over the past years. And now the issue somehow has been solved because the US Marines decided to withdraw most of its troops from Norway. So this is also going to disappear from the bilateral agenda. Although we can expect that some other issues will pop out in the Russian propaganda, like the visits of the US submarines in Norway, the fact that this year it was the first time since the end of the Cold War that the American air carrier entered the waters of the high north and so on and so on. So this is something that we need to be able to assess the real impact and then see how this is going to be played by propaganda further to the east.
Thank you. And Dr. Pinkus, did you want to come in on that direct question?
Sure. I think that is one of the questions that we need to grapple with. But I would observe that if you look at what nations are sending warships to conduct maritime operations in the Arctic in the last couple of years, it has been a number of non-Arctic states, most prominently the UK and the French. The British have been very active in the Barents this year. And so I think the idea that, and that quote that I cited in my presentation demonstrates that Russia is very sensitive to security activities conducted by non-Arctic NATO states. And so I think the idea that we would be excluding those very important security actors from some kind of dialogue leaves a big gap. And it's important to be discussing maritime security affairs with the actors that are active in the Arctic maritime. It's worth asking, I think, about whether Sweden and Finland, whose naval forces are not active in the Arctic, being Baltic states, I think thinking about the right group of nations that should be discussing security in the Arctic is an open question. And I don't think it's as easy as saying Arctic states or non-Arctic states. Thanks.
Thank you. And Colonel Solly, did you have any comments on this question?
Oh, yes. Nordic balance is actually a Cold War phenomenon. It was a situation where Norway has self-imposed the restrictions for having no foreign troops permanently stationed in Norway. And when the Soviets had some discussions regarding placing Soviet forces in Finland, some people claimed that Norway said that, well, if you do that, we will reevaluate our national restraints regarding foreign bases in Norway. And then the Soviets apparently refrained from positioning any troops in Finland. So that was the so-called Nordic balance from the Cold War. But they, Russia cannot dictate actually who is going to be involved in the Arctic and the high north. You know, as long as they operate the various forces in international waters and international airspace, you know, they don't have any the position to dictate who is going to be there. So if UK or France wants to operate their naval forces or the air forces in that international space, you know, they can do so. And also from Norwegian point of view, we also welcome foreign activity to balance, you know, this huge Russian military presence in our neighborhood.
Thank you. I'm going to try and squeeze this question in because it leads so nicely into the final panel of today's conference. This question is coming from Hans-Peter Mittun, who was the former defense attaché to Ukraine. The question is, we tend to evaluate the security situation in the Black Sea and the Arctic as two different areas, but both regions are equally essential to Russia. Are Russian national interests in the Arctic different than in the Black Sea? And if not, what are the lessons for the Arctic from Russian aggression in the Black Sea? I'd like you to answer as briefly as you can because we're already slightly over time. So who would like to pick up on that question, the Black Sea versus Arctic for Russian? let's go with Professor Godzimirsky first and then Dr. Pinkus.
In very short, one can say that when we look at the Arctic and the Black Sea region, then we have something that could be called a common denominator. And this common denominator in security terms is namely Russia, because we cannot expect that Russia will adopt different sets of instruments to pursue its objectives in the Black Sea region and in the Arctic. So this is why this question of potential spillover effects is so central in the Norwegian debate, because we don't expect Russia to have any kind of negative approach towards Norway itself, but Russia is a kind of not only regional but also a global power, so we should expect that when there are some issues elsewhere, Russia will react, and having in mind that those two-thirds of Russian second strike capability is located on 100 kilometers from the Norwegian border, this makes this border a very special line on the map, which means that this common denominator is Russia, and this is my short answer.
Thank you. Dr. Pinkus?
Very briefly, I would just say geography and climate change. You know, the Black Sea dynamics have been settled. The Arctic region has traditionally been closed for Russia. It has been a very safe space. It is opening up. And as Russia develops its core interests there, which are the exploitation of resources and the development of the natural sea route, that naturally involves bringing outsiders in. And that is a very different dynamic. So I think that's one of the key things that sets those two regions apart. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, Colonel Solly, any very brief remarks on that?
No, I agree with the previous speakers. Nothing to add.
Thank you. That means we're only a few minutes over time. I apologize to anyone who is expecting a longer break between panels. So I won't give an in-depth summary of what we've discussed, but just like to thank the panelists very much for their time. So Colonel Solly, Professor Godzimirsky, and Dr. Pinkus, we really appreciate you sharing your thoughts. I'd just like to quickly say that very, very shortly, the final panel of the session, which will be on the militarization of the Black Sea region and the consequences for the Southeast Europe region, will be starting very shortly. So I hope you will remain with us. So thank you very much to our panelists, and we will see the audience again soon.
Thank you.